I like to think about ways that we as coaches and scientists can spin the data to our advantage. And these are tools that we use. They're not tools that are using us, essentially.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the 80/20 Endurance Podcast. I'm Hannah Hunstead, your co-host, and today we're exploring the world of human performance, data-driven insights, and innovation. Our guest, Sean Allen, is a human performance researcher known for her ability to blend data, science, and technology to enhance athletic and personal achievements. Her journey spans agile industry research, elite sports environments, and cutting-edge innovation. Sean is part of the Lululemon innovation team currently, and she's been shaping the future of human performance. She joins us today to share her approach and insights into pushing the boundaries of what's possible in your athletic pursuits. Enjoy.
Sean Allen, welcome to 80/20 Endurance, the podcast that's 80% wearable and 20% unwearable. How you doing?
Amazing. Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. In another life, I will be an exercise scientist, but the best I can do in this life is talk to exercise scientists like you. It's always a delight. I can be a fan of particular researchers. I'm a fan of yours. So this is a fun opportunity. And I tell you what, I know a lot about your work. I don't know too much about your life's journey. So I figured I would start by asking you, were you an athlete growing up?
Yeah, I was. I actually played soccer, football, as we call it in the UK. I played in the English Women's Premier League, but this was before things were professional. So instead of following that as a path, I thought perhaps the next best thing I can do is become a sports scientist alongside that. So I think 20 years later, perhaps I would have been a pro athlete, but at the time it didn't happen. So ended up down the sports scientist path instead.
Oh, so you weren't just an athlete. You were a pretty darn good one.
Matt's like, did you play in middle school or nope, at the very top?
Yeah, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the English Premier League at all, but I played for the Everton women's team, which is one of the big teams kind of over there. But yeah, caveat, it was 20 years ago. The standard was probably a little bit different than it is today. So I wouldn't put myself in that elite athlete bucket, that's for sure.
So after the science bug kind of bit you, where'd you go from there? I know you have an interesting path with swimmers. I was a swimmer growing up, so I found that quite interesting. But tell us a little bit more about the path after that.
Yeah, so then I went to study sports science over in the UK at the University of Bath and did a few kind of internships while I was studying, working with a bunch of different athletes in different sports to get different experience. And then the first job that I got out of university was up in Scotland, working with the British swimming team up there. And this was in the lead up to the London 2012 Olympics. And what I was doing was essentially providing all sorts of like performance science support, including monitoring athletes through training and testing processes. And so a lot of what I was doing was collecting data from them that wearable technology collects almost for free today. So I'd be taking blood samples before training to look at glucose levels, measuring heart rate variability, measuring sleep quality through questionnaires, those kinds of things, except it took sort of hours on end to collect the data and go through it in those days versus these days. And actually, one of the things I started to realize going through this process was that there was so much data available from these athletes. And I wanted to go away and actually acquire better skills to be able to understand these data to provide more impactful recommendations. And so that was the trigger for me to go and do my PhD. And I moved to New Zealand to do that. And when I was over in New Zealand, I was also working with the swimming team there, the Olympic team and the Paralympic teams. But this time collecting data and looking at using kind of data analytics and modeling to better understand how different variables predict performance and or predict athletes who will be more successful than others through their development journey. So I stayed over in the New Zealand high performance sports system for about 6 years, working through to the Rio Games. And as I was working with the kind of athletic groups there, I started to think about, oh, there's so much kind of information and knowledge that we have that's getting applied to like the best of the best athletes, these Olympic and Paralympic athletes. What if we could translate some of that more to like the wider population, recreational athletes, knowing that a lot of these technologies were also getting better at the same time. And so that prompted me to want to move more into a bit more of the commercial space. And so 5.5 years ago, I moved to work with Lululemon, a sports apparel and kind of retailer and kind of technology group going on the west coast of Canada, which is where I've been ever since, working on kind of developing sports products, sports technology, and kind of researching how these can help improve the performance and experience of various different athletes across a wide range of sports.
Small world moment, Sean. I have a younger brother who did a year in Bath. Junior year abroad, but I'm dating myself here because he's my younger brother and he was there in, I think, 1992-93. But I'm curious to know if in the process of getting formal education in exercise science, if you had one or more like special mentors along the way, people who made an outsized impact in your growth in the profession. And if so, you're welcome to give shout outs, name names.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky to actually be exposed to people in this space very early in my career. And there are a couple of folks that come to mind. One was actually the first kind of placement I did as part of my degree, which was with a professional rugby team in the UK. And I, again, will caveat this by saying like, I didn't know anything about rugby union at the time. I sort of jumped straight into it with 2 feet. And the mentor that I had, his name was Pete Harding, and he was a very brash Australian, said it exactly how it was. And he sort of said to me, you won't survive in this kind of environment unless you are able to translate scientific principles into something that's actionable and engaging for these athletes. Otherwise, they just won't want to know. And so that really stuck with me throughout my career. And then I was lucky enough to have a similar mentor a bit later in my career, where I worked at the English Institute of Sport, and Steve Ingham, who was the head of physiology at the time. He was, again, a great mentor to me and helped me really understand the power and the value of applied practice, taking what you learn from the complex science and the art of distilling it down into something simple, and also being able to engage with athletes and coaches around that to actually get them to buy into what you're doing and help them change their behavior. And so it was really that translation from the academic world that it's very easy to get stuck in to the applied world and things that are actually actionable and useful for people.
From a lot of my online scoping out of your work, it seems like you do kind of always relate it to the behavioral side, which makes sense because that's what us commoners need from the scientific data to apply it to our lives. But I just appreciated that and wanted to say that, and that in podcasts you've been on and things, you always say it's always about the behavior, not about the actual data. And I don't want to make this whole conversation about wearables because I know you talk about that a lot. But in one podcast I was listening that you were on, they were talking about the Whoop, and I was a Whoop user for a while, especially during COVID, where all I was kind of doing was working out and going crazy like everyone else. So it kind of became my religion a little bit. Like, I would wake up and even if I felt fine, I would look at my recovery score. And if it said, oh, like not a good day, I wouldn't work out. Like I would say, nope, my Whoop said this and this. And especially in COVID times, like that was my saving grace, was to at least get outside, go on a walk or a run or whatever. So I was just wondering what recommendations in general, like overall after your career of exercise science, what do you have for athletes that are hung up on data? And I'm sure you get this question a lot, but like, what are the things that you've picked out that really work for people to apply if they're getting hung up with their data?
Yeah, I think the key thing, and this is becoming even more true with the more and more data that we have available to us, is to be really clear on the questions that you're trying to answer with it. And what you're essentially optimizing for, which can be very different. If you're an elite athlete and you're prepared to almost give up anything in search of performance versus if you're perhaps a bit more recreational and you want to perform well, but you also still want to make sure you have time to spend with your family, let's say. So it really starts mm-hmm. with defining like the key questions you're trying to answer and the constraints, I guess, you have around it. Essentially, what are you optimizing for? And then there isn't like one set path. I know with the way a lot of these algorithms and apps are set up, they're very general right now in terms of the recommendations they're making. I always encourage folks to layer on their context to it. and to interpret more of the raw data with the context involved rather than just looking at like a general recommendation or an overall score that's applied without that context, let's say. Mm-hmm. So I think it's nuance, which unfortunately makes it a little bit more complicated, but there are some very simple kind of questions that you can answer in terms of, yes, what are you optimizing for? What are you prepared to give up in order to achieve those things? And then you can start to look at, okay, well, this data is probably most useful to me and I can ignore mm-hmm. like most of the rest of it.
Yeah. So almost like go in with knowing what you want to get out of it before you even look at any of the data.
100%. Yeah. And also the other thing, this certainly came up a lot in my work with elite athletes, but it's knowing what's a meaningful change in the data versus what's like error of measurement or what's noise in the data. So if you're looking at your resting heart rate, for example, and it's changing by 1 to 2 beats per minute each day, that's probably just within the error of measurement of the device. You don't want to be necessarily reacting to those changes, even if directionally it's up or down. There's like a threshold beyond which you can say, okay, based on, you know, my typical baseline and variability, if it's outside of this range, that's when I need to take action, because it's a deviation from normal versus being overly reactive to just some of those directional changes that are probably accounted for by, yeah, just error of measurement in the device or natural day-to-day variability for people.
Yeah. And I just have a follow-up question with that. You know, going from working with athletes to now a company like Lululemon that sells products, what level of responsibility do you place on companies for how they display this data? Like one example from the Whoop for me was, it was red or green, and red was like, got to the point where it's kind of triggering. And I know that's a personal thing that I probably needed to work on at the time. The choice of words that they use, like Garmin saying your training is unproductive, things like that. Like what responsibility do you think companies have in their display of this data?
Yeah, I think there's a big responsibility to like do due diligence in that space. The main thing for me really is around transparency, I suppose, and helping people understand what some of the implications of some of these data could be, not necessarily making those jumping to those inferences for them, because I think that's where it can, like, it can, it depends how people are wired in terms of how they interpret this information. But I know, as you mentioned, there are certain types of people who can be predisposed to like be overly anxious about some of these things. And I just think we don't know enough yet, because these things haven't been out in the wild yet for long enough to be able to say what the long-term effects of those are. So I definitely think I would err on the side of, like, I guess, caution around some of those recommendations, and also knowledge of what some of those, I guess, design features can do to folks mm-hmm. versus like just actually serving them up the information rather than putting like a particular slant on it that may be, you know, maybe interpreted a certain way. So I definitely think there's like a due diligence ethics piece there that, yeah, should be top of mind.
Recently, I was approached by the manufacturer of a wearable device that was intended for use by endurance athletes. And they wanted me to be a kind of advisor to them from, obviously I'm not a scientist, but from a coach's perspective. And I was interested in the technology. I thought it was potentially useful. But from speaking from my coaching perspective, I told them, you know, because they were looking for kind of use cases for the product. And I told them I would use it as a tool for cultivating self-regulatory capacity in endurance athletes, because that's the name of the game. You know, at the end of the day, it's you're going by feel, and your limits are perceptually defined in endurance sports. And I thought it had a lot of value used in this way. And it was quite clear that the manufacturer didn't like that they actually wanted athletes to be as dependent as possible on the tool. And I think there's like, you know, there's a tension there. I mean, just think about just how abjectly or shamelessly some cell phone app makers and social media app companies go to, you know, just monkey around with our neurochemistry to foster dependency, because it's in their commercial interest to do. But I think, you know, it's got to be possible for someone to break out of that pattern and take a chance on effective coaching, because the potential is there. Are the incentives too strong on the commercial side? I'm hoping you're going to say no, and that, you know, some of these wearable manufacturers will be actually open to that input, because like I said, I see the potential.
Yeah. And I think I'm actually starting to see a little bit of that trend play out as well. Now with some of these folks who have been playing around with these technologies for a certain amount of time, they've almost worn them for a year or however long it is, learned enough about how they typically respond to know that they don't need to wear that technology anymore. It's almost served its purpose. The question for me for these companies would be, okay, you've solved that problem. What's the next problem these people are dealing with? Like for them, let's go after that versus trying to create a dependency that won't necessarily be healthy for people in that space. And then there's a whole other market out there for people who have no idea about this stuff that, you know, they could still use a lot of support in that space. But the trend that I have started to see is almost like this concept that over-optimization almost equals fragility, whereby like, let's say you're on the start line of a race, your wearable dies halfway through the race and you're completely dependent on it. Then what do you do? Like you haven't prepared for that, or your battery dies, or whatever it is. At the end of the day, you still have to do that performance regardless of technology or whatever happens. How do you make sure you have the resilience to do that? If you're always reliant on something like this, that's probably not the best preparation. And that holds true for technology or you know, frankly, anything else in terms of like how you prepare for competition, I would think. So I definitely see that trend starting to play out in athletes and coaches with like a bit more experience with some of this stuff. So I think that will start to grow, to be honest.
Well, you know, there's an even subtler scenario. Like what if your device is working beautifully on race day, but every day you're a different athlete? And so, you know, maybe your device has trained you that you're only capable of this. And you just have one of those days when you got magic legs and you actually have the potential for a breakthrough performance, the device could hold you back or do the opposite, which is a more common scenario. You wake up with, you know, dead legs on a given day and you know, you've been trained by your device, you know, that dependency, like, well, this is what I can do. And, you know, without that ability to just feel your way to, you know, maximal performance on the given day, it's like the device could be functioning exactly as it was designed to and still not serve your interests.
Yeah, that's where I think it's interesting the role that a scientist or a coach can play in terms of helping the athlete interpret the data, but with a positive performance benefit. So the example that I always like to think of is that there are probably many days in training where you had a bad night's sleep or you wake up, your recovery score is poor, and you can still do a good session. And so those are data points as well in terms of being able to give you that confidence that I can actually perform no matter what this device says. And that can actually be even more powerful than waking up and having a good score, because you have the confidence that no matter what happens, you know you can still perform well because you've done the work or whatever it is. And so I like to think about ways that we as coaches and scientists can spin the data to our advantage. And these are tools that we use. They're not tools that are using us, essentially.
That's a good point.
It seems like it's a really exciting time to be an exercise scientist. It's kind of contradictory. Like the more technology we have right now, the more important your job is, it seems. Whereas like AI is taking over, ChatGPT is taking, you know, people are scared of their jobs, but it seems like it actually benefits you because we need someone to explain it all. But as far as like social media goes, I am kind of getting the sense that because it's becoming more popular, it's almost like your influencer status. And so what is your take on social media and like what sense of, again, kind of responsibility do you have on certain platforms? I know your Twitter is a big deal for good reason.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I think like when I think about my personal journey as well, I think perhaps in the past when these platforms weren't available, the only kind of mechanisms that sports scientists had to disseminate knowledge was to the athletes directly in front of them. And now I think there's been this like democratization of technology and data such that, you know, most people can go out and buy a Whoop or an Aura, but most people still can't access a sports scientist or a coach like in the same way as they can buy that technology. And so I think these social media platforms offer the opportunity for folks at kind of any level of performance to perhaps follow the right people or follow the feeds of the right people working in these spaces. I think the challenge is always discerning the signal from the noise, which is hard to do probably without some kind of background in some of these areas. And so I definitely feel a responsibility as someone coming from like a scientific background to try and make information actionable, but also valid and robust as well. And also call out where we just don't know. We don't have enough information. And it's like, what I would often try and do is just share, like, these are some considerations or questions to ask or things to think about. And science doesn't have all the answers. And so if people are telling you they have all the answers, that's probably a red flag in my mind. So there's some nuances to it. But I think the amazing thing about these platforms is the fact that we can reach anyone from, you know, someone doing their first marathon that takes 7 hours to like the best of the best athletes, and folks can tap into that kind of wherever they are. So I definitely think there will be more push from the academic and scientific community to use these channels in future. I think it will just continue to kind of spiral onto different platforms. Like, it's already happening on TikTok and other platforms as well. I think, yeah, the challenge will just be to, like, I guess, maintain the robustness of the information through these different mediums and also, like, adapt to the audience.
As someone who's been at this for a long time in the role of coach, I'm conscious of kind of the state of play has evolved. And to Hannah's point about influential exercise scientists being able to sort of go directly to the athletes, it's like there's less reliance on being mediated through peer-reviewed journals that coaches then read that they just sort of pass on. And I feel kind of two ways about it. I have a belief that most good coaches are foxes rather than hedgehogs. They're people, they're generalists. They're good at seeing the big picture. A lot of good scientists are hedgehogs. They have great analytical skills, great attention to detail. For me, I follow you on Twitter because I find it very informative. And I think of you more as like maybe both fox and hedgehog. When I shut up, I'll give you a chance to say what you are. But I mean, you do a nice job of being empathetic and sort of understanding where athletes are and presenting information in ways that I think will lead them in the right direction versus the wrong. But I do see some hedgehog scientists on Twitter, and I feel like I'm able to sort of take the information and then sort of absorb it and manipulate it in ways that are helpful to athletes. But I worry about athletes who are coming to that straight, just seeing the information and it's not properly contextualized or interpreted. And they could just like run out and act on it in ways that aren't in their best interest. Are you conscious of like the same kind of tension? I think, you know, there can be a really symbiotic relationship between coaches and scientists, but there's also maybe an inherent tension there and even like a little bit of a turf war.
Oh yeah, completely. Like, you definitely need a filter, I think, as you're coming into this world, which is where it's probably helpful for people to have a coach to help them filter some of this information, knowing that they will probably have had more exposure to this kind of world. I think my philosophy is, as you said, like encouraging, I guess, transparency and awareness of information that's available, and provide the caveats so that people can make the best informed decisions for them. Not necessarily about this is right, this is wrong, just because people really have such unique context. And it's like, that's the strength that they bring. And this is just, you know, another source of information that they can use to help make better decisions. I think, yeah, there are some specific red flags for me around one way is the best way, or these things are definitely true, like all of those kinds of things as general rules. I think for people who are fresh coming into this space would be things to look out for. And I would encourage people to actually like connect with a coach or a scientist or someone who can actually filter this information and make it relevant to them as a good first step if you feel like you don't have the background to make those decisions yourself.
I wanted to talk more about you working with professional athletes, and I think I'm maybe particularly interested because they were swimmers, but what did you learn about working with these high competitive athletes? Did it have any impact on your own training or on you as an athlete outside of the data that you were collecting with them?
Yeah, I think my primary reflection as you ask that is actually I came into working with athletes very much as a physiologist, looking at like the mechanisms of, oh, if we change this in the training, this will happen to performance, and we'll just test it and we'll change this and we'll tweak it and repeat it. And what I learned was what we chatted about before, that so much of your impact as a physiologist or perhaps as a coach as well is caught up in that world of behavior change. And you have to, even the highest level athletes that I worked with, there was so much kind of psychology involved in getting them to buy into perhaps changing a routine that they've used for 10 years and trying something new, even though the science suggested it might work. There's just a lot of things going on there for them to sometimes step into that. And so much of, like, I've discussed this with, I guess, other friends who worked in the physiology space, so much of what you do actually ends up incorporating psychology and kind of behavioral science in ways that I didn't even consider before I got into those environments. And so much of it really is in how you can frame things for people and the stories that you're able to tell in order to convince them to try something out and help them kind of understand the value of it. So that was the big shift for me, I think.
Sean, the way you answered that question, actually, it ended up being not much of a pivot to me. So with that said, so there's one, I won't name names, but there's one particular hedgehog on social media who recently tweeted something to the effect that the best coaches are stoics, because athletes can tend to have so much emotion tied up in their training and racing that coaches shouldn't add to that by like responding to emotion or showing emotion themselves. And what struck me, I mean, just the sheer wrongness of that statement struck me first. What struck me second was that that is not an evidence-based position. Like if you look at the research on what makes coaches effective, it's 80% psychology. You know what I mean? Like we have a lot of data on that. And this guy just is either unaware of it or just, you know, dismisses it because he knows so much about physiology. It's like, it's gotta be all physiology. So I want to flip this around. Like that's me being critical of people who are, you know, not being helpful on the scientific side, but how about coaches? You must look at coaches and get a little frustrated with them and feel like maybe, you know, some of us aren't taking it upon ourselves to bone up on exercise science and maybe being dismissive of it. How adept or how much scientific literacy should coaches have in order to be able to do their jobs effectively?
It's interesting you ask that question because I've definitely had conversations with people and actually the mentor that I referenced earlier, he said he used to call sports scientists sports historians because they essentially validated what coaches have been doing for years that worked. And so I think there's a lot to be said for, like, I would go into any relationship with a coach assuming that that is true and they have done the due diligence. I think where the scientific literacy can aid is in understanding the mechanisms for how things work the way they do, such that when you want to make new decisions, you can again leverage those mechanisms or double down on them to sort of amplify the performance effects that you're getting through your training. So I think that's where it helps. And I also think the scientific method helps in terms of helping either validate or challenge those assumptions in action, whereby let's try something, let's change it, and let's actually make sure that we can assess whether it works by having, you know, a robust kind of let's compare performance here to performance here. And so I think those are two ways in which it can be really powerful. But then I also have kind of a huge appreciation for what kind of coaches innately have learned and put into practice just through how they operate, which I think I haven't always seen kind of on the scientific side. It's always like, let's question where this has come from. I think it's like you can get to the same endpoint through different paths and they're equally respectable. I think it's like, let's leverage both of those to create even more impact moving forward.
I'm dying to follow up. I'm sorry.
I could feel it. That's why, again, I long pause.
All right. This is, you know, perhaps a very esoteric question, but, you know, I have a feeling that's just based on, you know, experience in the trenches that, well, I look at endurance sports training as a complex adaptive system. And sometimes when you just understand enough to be dangerous about complex systems is that disruption can be intrinsically beneficial. So like, it doesn't necessarily matter what the disruptor is, because you're trying to break out of local attractors and maybe just get some movement so that if there's a way to better performance out there, sometimes you just need to be dislodged from, you know, patterns that have started to kind of calcify. And I think that's why maybe you sometimes fail to get additive effects from individual interventions that have very different mechanisms. And you think, oh, if we do all three of these things that are proven to have effect, it's going to have triple the effect. And then you do it and it's like, no, it's just the same as any one of them alone. Cause it's like, I don't want to like overstate the case, but I think there is something to that idea that like, as a coach, I won't just like randomly pick a disruptor in order to keep athletes from becoming too comfortable with existing patterns. I will carefully select things to try, but I don't get too caught up in thinking I have to pick the perfect thing to try next. Cause I feel like like maybe any one of three or four things that has some proven efficacy could do the job I'm really trying to do, which is keep evolving.
Yeah. And I think you also have to consider, perhaps with the scenario you shared, if you introduce three or four things, there's like a cognitive load that's associated with that. It's like, that's a lot to throw at people on top of their existing training program. And so that's a factor that isn't often considered. And the other one related to any kind of intervention, and perhaps this is where the success of each of them individually comes into play, is it's like leveraging that placebo effect or the belief effect that goes with it, which is all right. In like, I guess, the storytelling piece that you put around it, how you frame it for the athlete, how you set it up for them, which I think, yes, the intervention is one piece of that. And there may be like logical mechanisms behind it, but we also need to take a good amount of consideration to how we frame it and set up that intervention. A lot of times, like even some of the success or what I've observed in working with swimming, where I was working with a few different squads at the same time, I might be working with one coach who was willing to implement an intervention. And then the other coaches would see it and think, oh, they're doing something interesting. Like, I'll do it no matter what it is, just because they see like, oh, they're doing something sciencey, so that's definitely going to help. And so there's like all these other different effects that go on that it's hard sometimes to parse, like, what's the actual thing that's causing the change. But if you're taking care of, I guess, all these like small details and trying to optimize them and you get to the performance outcome, like that's really what we're kind of going after, I guess. So it's, yeah, just encouraging people to think a bit more broadly than just like the textbook intervention.
Yeah, going off of that, Matt, you wrote a blog post about athletes coming to you to question some of your coaching techniques. So, Sean, my question for you is, these athletes that now, like we talked about, it's all on social media, whether it's right or wrong, like science or exercise scientists like yourself are putting things out there, and hopefully most of the time they're true, but you also only have a certain amount of characters. So the way that the athlete could take something in that one tweet could actually not be what it actually means. So what advice do you have for an athlete that is someone who is really into data and science and getting all of this information and all of the time and bringing it to their coach? Like, what's a recommendation for those athletes that are trying to capitalize, like Matt said, like three things at once?
Yeah, I think one of the ways I definitely look at it is like understanding how you're wired as an athlete, or how your different athletes are wired, both, I guess, physically and mentally, in terms of, for some people, they can respond and be overly anxious about things, so it's just not worth introducing it. Whereas for other people, they really like it and they kind of can double down on it. So I think that's the first thing I'd always think about. Yes, there are generic recommendations put out there, but you have to consider, like, for you as an athlete, for your personality, whatever, is it worth pursuing this from the mental side as well as the physical side? So I think that's definitely where I would start on that one. Probably the other things to say on that, probably related to, are there times in your training, in the same way that you periodize training, could you also periodize potentially introducing new interventions or new ideas at periods of like lower risk, let's say? So when I worked in Olympic sports, it was like, let's take the first year of the Olympic cycle, let's try changing training. And if it doesn't work, you know, there's not much risk there, versus like, we're not going to do it in 6 months before the Olympics. So how does that sit? Mm-hmm. Like, how can you kind of periodize these things and maximize the opportunity and lower the risk?
Yeah. Follow-up question to that is, and you kind of answered it, but if there's anything else that you can embellish on, did you see any coaches when you were working with these swim teams, for example, like what were the best practices of coaches implementing new strategies with their athletes' training?
I think so much of it, when I really dissect a lot of what they were trying to do, if I look at like swimming physiology, swimming is renowned for doing a large amount of volume in comparison to the amount of time athletes are actually competing for. So like a 100-meter event, let's say it's less than a minute, they might do like, 70K training weeks or something like that. So that paradigm was really interesting. And I remember having a bunch of conversations with coaches about this. And I said, well, why do you do so much volume? Because if you look at the physiology, it doesn't always make sense. And they said, you know, primarily, I think the reason we do it is to give the athletes confidence that they've done all the work they can do, so that when they stand on the blocks, they know they can beat anyone next to them, because they're almost like superhuman, because they've survived these things. And so, like, almost harking back to that, I think what I see in the best practices from coaches is finding ways to give athletes confidence in the training that they've done, or from the data that they have, even if they haven't prepared perfectly, how can they frame it to make the athletes believe that they've done exactly what they need to do to be standing on the start line, standing on the blocks, and knowing that they are in the best possible shape to do their PB or win the race. And that, yeah, that's where I come back to, how can we leverage wearable data to also be able to do that? How can scientists support that, no matter what the actual physiology or design of the training is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we coaches actually have an easier job than you scientists have. Like, you're trying to be, this is oversimplifying, but like, you're trying to be right, and we're just trying to be effective. And often, like, you know, you can just really not worry about being right, you know, like with placebo effects or buy-in, things like the storytelling factors, training more than you need to, you know, just because you know the psychological effect it will have. As a coach, it's just kind of a looser standard. You don't have to necessarily be able to defend the practice, you know, in a debate. It just has to work, or at least work better than whatever the opponent is doing. But also, I wanted to get back to your point about, like, you know, I love that line about exercise scientists being exercise historians. One thing to keep in mind, like, we're talking about these categories as if they're utterly distinct, but there are plenty of scientists out there who are also coaches, who are also athletes. And if you look at the history of innovation, take a sport like the modern sport of distance running, which goes back to, you know, the mid-19th century, and you look at, like, key innovations that happened, you know, in training along the way, those have come from mostly historically elite athletes and their coaches. But who says that pattern has to hold? Like, I could see, I mean, couldn't it change? Might we be on, you know, in the evolution of your discipline, could we be sort of at a threshold where we actually see more impactful innovations originating, you know, in the lab, so to speak?
Yeah, I think we're probably at a good tipping point for that, because I guess to think about, like, dissect that scenario of sports historians, it's probably that coaches had the most amount of data points, as it were, for to use a kind of a crude term, with the athletes having worked with them for years and years, versus scientists who aren't always there at each of those training sessions. Whereas now what we're able to do is collect all those data points independently of anyone being there, and to be able to look at that data through a new lens to understand how we might tweak things at an even finer level. And so I think, yeah, it is kind of pertinent to think about it that way, that may have been somewhat true in the past, but the opportunity in the future lies with more of the integration. And I think with this idea of people almost being prepared to take some of these risks or try things based on, like, some of these inclinations or hypotheses that are coming up, and not necessarily being stuck in the, this is the way we've always done it, so this is the way we're always going to do it. I think the opportunity is to test and learn, as it were, or to find ways to do that are as low risk as possible.
Yeah, there's risk on both sides, isn't there? Like, if you don't innovate, you risk falling behind. But if you fail to be selective in how you innovate, there's probably far greater risk on that side.
Yeah. To what you said earlier about scientists always feeling like they need to be right, I kind of look at it as to be a little bit less wrong. How can we increase the odds of being a little bit less wrong and making better decisions rather than knowing that we're going to be right? Because
we need to test and learn. So imagine this, you're not going to like this, Sean, but imagine you're at the end of your career and you're receiving, like, a lifetime achievement award for the tremendous impact you've had on your field. Let's just pretend that this scenario comes to pass. You're getting a lifetime achievement award for contributions to exercise science. What will be the substance of that impact? When nice things are said about you at the rostrum in this ceremony, like, what will they say your impact was?
So there's this really nice quote that I like that comes to mind, which is, it's the mark of a genius to take something complex and make it simple, and the mark of a charlatan to take something simple and make it complex. And so when I think about that, I think about my legacy being the ability to take complicated or complex scientific constructs that live deep in a scientific paper that five people have ever read, and pulling out the key bits and translating them in a way to coaches, athletes, members of the public, other scientists, that make it actionable, but also capture the scientific essence of what's being said and kind of hold the validity and robustness of it true. So it really comes down to, I think, the ability to translate scientific information to a a broader audience and make it useful, not just living in a textbook or in a research paper where it doesn't help anyone.
Right on.
Put it in a Love tweet. It.
Exactly. Or what other media, whatever medium people relate to it in, just making it accessible for people. 100%.
Okay. Well, super deep closing question number two. I don't think we've ever had two on an episode, so you're our first one. But mine is more of an all or nothing question. If you had to continue on, you as an athlete, with the amount of data that you wanted, you could wear your watch, your Whoop, your Oura Ring, everything. You could have it all. Would you have that, or would you rather have none of it?
I would say, based on having already done that, now I would have none of it. But if I hadn't done it, I would probably choose the first one. So I could learn what I wanted to learn and then choose to say, I don't need this, or I can be self-reliant.
That's a
without
workaround.
I know. How do you like them apples?
That was well done. But that's the answer I wanted to hear, because that adds a lot of nuance to the question, because it really is the answer is both, but in a certain sequence, right?
Yeah. It's not like a one size fits all, like lifelong dependency, as we talked about. It's like, I think is it the Bruce Lee quote where it's like, absorb everything, take what's useful and discard what's not. It's sort of, that's the sort of paradigm I would apply.
And add
to that.
Something uniquely yours.
Ah,
that's part of the quote.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, I'm actually going to close this up with a quote from you now, because I think it kind of sums everything up that we've talked about, and then we'll finally let you go. But it's one of your tweets, and you said, "Technology works best when it helps us navigate the inevitable uncertainty of life, not makes it easier for us." And I just really liked that one, so I wanted to wrap it up with that tweet. And thank you for giving us your time today to chat with us.
Absolutely. Good little mic drop moment there. Thank you for having me. This was a really fun chat.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Bye.
As we wrap up this episode, I encourage you to take Sean's insights to heart. Whether you're a seasoned athlete or coach striving for excellence, or simply intrigued by the science of performance, her wisdom offers a roadmap to reach new heights in your endurance journey. It wouldn't be an 80-20 endurance podcast without our What Is Your Jam segment, and mine for the week is You and Me by Butterbath. With summer coming to a close here in the States, this song just kind of sounds like a sunset, and a sunset on the summer season specifically. So enjoy that. You can find more information about Sean, her work, 80-20 Endurance, and my jam in the show notes. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram at 80-20 Endurance for more incredible episodes and updates. And if you found this conversation as enlightening as I did, please share it with your fellow athletes, friends, and anyone seeking to push their limits. Chat next week.